You're listening to A Little Too Quiet, the Ferndale Library podcast, brought to you by the friends of the Ferndale Library. My name's Jeff Milo, and I am caffeinated, and I'm joined by Roddy. Hello.
Hello.
Roddy really wanted to record the episode you're about to listen to. You are entering a world of sight and sound and terror. It's a signpost up ahead. You are entering the Twilight Zone. If I had reached maybe into some public domain, I would have sampled some music right here. I may still do that. We are talking only about the Twilight Zone, and specifically about the original 5-season run from 1959 to 1964. Roddy.
Well, I don't even know what to say because we just recorded it, so I'm just so happy.
Yeah, we were joined by a relatively world-famous author of horror named Josh Mellerman, who is a Michigan native, former Ferndale resident in the Metro Detroit area, author of Bird Box, the Netflix sensation, and The Twilight Zone was a formative influence on his writing, and we talk a lot about that. This is just three Twilight Zone fans nerding out. It was truly a fan rant.
It was, and it was in rant in the positive sense of, you know, honestly, I don't like to use this term all the time, but just me fangirling about all these episodes because it is such a good show. I don't know if we'll ever get TV like that again.
So if you're a fan of the show, you're going to like this episode. Here's our chat with Josh Mellerman. Yes. Well, we're so glad to have you here, Josh. Thanks for joining us.
Yes.
When you first told me about the books you were writing, I think that Twilight Zone came up early as a formative influence as far as what you were going for when it came to writing scary-ish stories, right?
Man, the first horror movie I ever saw was Twilight Zone, the movie.
Yes.
And what an intro, because it has variety, right? So literally my introduction, and the second movie was Creepshow. So both anthologies,
yeah.
Both the stories don't have to be unified, both promoting the idea of many ideas at once.
Right.
And I feel like I'm still like influenced almost subconsciously by those being the first two movies I ever saw, but not yet. Twilight Zone, the movie. If I'm not mistaken, and you both will know this, every segment in that is based on an actual episode, right?
Yes, okay. I think so.
For the most part.
And they at least irresistibly recreate Terror at 20,000 Feet.
Yes, yeah. They do.
Famously. And I feel like John Lithgow was in the mix of that movie.
Yes, he was actually, if I'm not mistaken, he was the person in 20,000
Feet. On the plane.
Yeah.
And amazing.
My favorite maybe horror anything I've ever seen is It's a Good Life, Anthony, in the movie, who can do anything with his mind, blah, blah, blah. And that episode is like on a farm. And I'm sure you both know that. I think it's called It's a Good Life,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So from 1959 to 1964, mm-hmm. there was an anthology series on television with standalone stories of science fiction, fantasy, horror, which wove in a hell of a lot of social commentary into the episodes and created just a groundswell of such a devoted fan base. But man, to this day, here we are, 63 years later, we still can't stop talking about it.
You will never be able to stop talking about this show, though, because even some of the like more scary concepts are presented in very humorous episodes as well. I've been talking to Jeff about this episode all week, but it's the final episode of season one. It's called A World of His Own, in which this playwright can write things into being and then to like discard them, he just burns the tape that they're on. And it's told as like a sort of domestic comedy. And every time I watch that episode, I'm like, this is actually so horrific. because I guess, spoiler alert, 60 years later, you find out that his wife is one of his characters.
Whoa.
And he burns the piece of tape that she's written on at the end so that he can then replace her with his newer ideal woman at the end of the episode. And it's told as a domestic comedy. And every time I watch it, I'm just like, this is terrifying.
You hear ideas that ripped off that, right? Like there's Stephen King's Word Processor of the Gods. Mm-hmm. There's some movie where I can't remember who it is, but he's like, might even be like John Candy or something. So I can't remember who it is, but like everything he types up happens around him. Maybe it's Tom Hanks. Anyway, it's from that era, like mid-80s mm-hmm. or something. But anyway, but the way you just described that makes me feel like that could be its whole own novel or something, you know, a person that's literally, and that's kind of like the Anthony character also from It's a Good Life, like able, like the God character that can create anything he or she wants. And obviously that's not a good thing.
Exactly.
That's an episode I wanted to talk about. It's a Good Life, right? That is, for some reason, that's the most scariest episode to me. And maybe it's because I've only watched it as an adult. Maybe if I watched it when I was younger. But the catatonic terror that is in the adults,
yeah,
acting as though everything is fine and we love the TV show that you set up for us and we're so glad. That's my stomach is turning just thinking of it, of a proposition of having to exist like that forever. Oh my gosh.
Especially at the whim of a child. And yes. That's kind of the biggest point.
That's the thing.
For me, I didn't find that episode so scary, but I did also watch it when I was a child. Mm-hmm. So I was just like, oh, he's just mean.
Right. But I do remember, and tell me if you agree, there was a sense of like one of the first times where I was like, wait a minute, adults could be afraid of us?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And like that was interesting, right? Because it's like when you see that as a kid, you're like, huh, what power do I wield around the house?
Right.
And it's also the fact that such a small child has that amount of power and also that amount of discernment about the adults around him. That is what instills that fear. It's a terrifying episode, don't get me wrong. But
it is, because he's the child is also retaining childlike qualities because his vengeance is sort of a jack-in-the-box.
Yes.
And that is a childlike element.
Yes. That's my scariest episode for me is...
You love season one.
I do love season one. It's one of the best like first seasons of television ever. Oh, it's from season three, Five Characters in Search of an Exit.
Oh, yeah.
I actually have a hard time watching that episode to this day. It makes me so anxious. And like the plot twist at the end, once you realize what the five characters are, I was just like, oh, that's genius. But the lead up is some of like, I've never felt so tense watching something before. And it's an episode that I like to try to return to, but it's so hard to watch again. Like I can watch It's a Good Life over and over and over again. Five Characters in Search of an Exit, I have to be in a good mood that day, mm-hmm. or else it's going to get existential.
Mm-hmm. I have the figurines of each of the five. Like I saw it on some website and they weren't that expensive. And I was like, oh, screwed. I'm just getting these.
That is so cool.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, all the figurines from these Twilight Zones, they're all in black and white. Mm-hmm. Like all the figurines are black and white. You know what I mean? And it's like that's pretty awesome because we never saw them any other way.
Right.
Yeah.
That is so cool. As a matter of fact, that kind of made the like more modern takes on the Twilight Zone not resonate with me as much because they were in color. I don't know why, but like I liked some of the newer productions and I thought they were like good homages to the original, but there is something about it being in black and white, which I know that was just the medium of the time, but that kind of like has transcended time and making it kind of special mm-hmm. still. I don't know. Makes it creepier.
So, here's something I was thinking of, not to leap, but I think this, I'd love to hear what you both say about this, is that I think one super interesting thing about the Twilight Zone is it breaks like a cardinal rule where it's like, it's not, how do I explain this? I don't believe that it's quote unquote character first, right? I think the reason we keep returning is because of the Twilight Zone itself, mm-hmm. meaning that any story can happen in any genre of story, any from humor to horrifying to sci-fi to Western to any to a family drama, anything can happen because the main character, the Twilight Zone, is present. Mm-hmm. And we, as viewers, want to go to the, you almost want it to happen to you. You almost want to have your car break down and you go over a hill to get it fixed. And then you're in the child, you know, the town you grew up in mm-hmm. and everyone's the same as it was. You almost want to get caught in that web yourself.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's a go-to that people say all the time is like, I feel like I'm in the Twilight Zone right now when something happens to them because
right.
of that feeling. I completely agree.
That's the conceit at the beginning that Rod tells us. This is the stumbling into a parallel dimension, a world not unlike our own. That's exactly it. I mean, it is an interesting thing to bring up the actual characters who are involved here. I almost think that part of the reason Time Enough at Last is so regarded and famous is because that's one of the most memorable characters. That's one of the most well-defined characters that you can latch onto. The others, to an extent, are kind of a cipher that you can or that you can just sort of glom onto, like the "what if I were there in their shoes" sort of situation.
I think that's
Burgess Meredith appreciation.
Yes, love him. Thank you. I think it's because the other characters are kind of like in their stories, but his character is the story for that particular episode. So yeah, because that was my first Twilight Zone episode ever. That was my introduction in a previous podcast, which is what's this whole thing. I told Jeff the story about how it was New Year's Eve when the Sci-Fi Channel was still doing their their marathon. Yeah, and I was heading over to like a friend's house because me and all my friends always get like a sleepover for New Year's Eve, and I was like doing chores before I left, and the TV was on, and it was on the Twilight Zone, and I just completely stopped doing everything I was supposed to do. I just sat and like watched that. I stood still literally in horror when his glasses broke at the end of the episode. I was just like, what is this? This is horrible. And it's amazing. I want to watch all of it now.
It's such a good gateway episode.
It is.
To get you on board.
Okay, you know, this is a conversation about the Twilight Zone is impossible to have without saying the one. What was the one? Or do you remember the one? Or do you, you know, the one I love, you know? And even that Twilight Zone, the movie, which I understand it's the same. Even the wraparound is Dan Aykroyd and what's that dude's name? Albert Brooks.
Yeah.
Like they're like, how about the one? So let me ask you, I just don't remember the name of the one where the kids are there for their father's will, and it's like till midnight.
The Mask. That's the one. Oh, yeah. I love that episode.
Yes. That episode is so good.
I was also talking to Jeff about that episode this week. Because I was like, and then they put on the mask, and then it becomes their faces, and then he dies because he was wearing the death mask. And yeah.
Which you also rank pretty high as scary.
Yes, it is. But so that episode is the family drama scary episode. That's why I like it so much. Mm-hmm. I like the Twilight Zone episodes where it's just like, oh, the story is an examination of the characters. And that's what that one is, because not a lot of action happens in that episode until the literal last moment. It's just very dialogue heavy about this patriarch who honestly resents his family and wants to kind of make them look at themselves for what they truly are. And that also involves changing their faces for the rest of their lives.
Right.
So
is that that's your one?
That might be my one scariest one, because I remember walking away from that feeling. There's some famous quote that by age 50, every man wears the face he deserves, you know? I think it might be Orwell or someone, but I always think about that. And the closer I get to 50, I'm like, how do I look? Do I look like a jerk, or do I look like a nice person? Am I happy? And that episode was that totally, that concept distilled, where it's like, this is who you actually are. Mm-hmm. And it just makes you feel like you're not going to be able to hide who you are. So you make yourself a better person instead.
There's another episode that also gets that reaction from me. It's called The Howling Man. That episode.
Josh is reaching for paraphernalia behind him.
Oh, did I?
I have the book, the story itself.
Oh, my goodness.
Charles Beaumont collection in here, as you both know.
Yes.
He wrote a bunch of episodes. And The Howling Man, oh my gosh, but go on.
It is just so good. I remember that I also watched that episode for the first time when I was young, and it was scary. But it's one that I can rewatch all the time, and it frustrates me every time, but I love it because it's just like, would you open the door? And unfortunately, I don't think there's a single person who wouldn't open the door, even if they know that they absolutely shouldn't. They will open the door, and it's just an endless cycle, and it is amazing. It's probably, I guess it would probably be my one in terms of like fear because as scary as like five characters in search of an exit is, it's just, that's very anxiety inducing. But the Howling Man scares me because I know there's no one who would be able to really resist that temptation.
Yeah.
So
you do realize that you're like, you're writing a marathon. What's the May 3rd marathon for me? The minute this ends, I'm watching.
I will make sure Jeff sends you over like the list.
Yep.
It's very season one heavy though.
Right.
But that was because someone asked me for Twilight Zone episode recommendations. And I was just like, well, there are so many episodes, but this is a list of season one episodes to kind of like get you started.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I don't even think I hit every, like there's honestly, people just need to watch the whole season, but there's just so much.
Have you seen every single episode?
I don't think so. Like the episode that Jeff recommended that I watched.
She'd never before, seen The Grave.
The Grave.
The Grave with Lee Marvin and Lee Van Cleef.
Fantastic episode. The sister was the best character. Yeah, she's amazing. And the dialogue was so much fun. Like, I know it's supposed to be a little like solemn, but I was just like, no, this is great.
Right.
The guy with the guitar, I can't remember anyone's name, but
this is a Twilight Zone Western, and some cowboy types are afraid to visit a grave. And Josh mentioned the sister as well. I think that the sound design was really scary to me, just the sound of wind and how they used it, even if it's a soundstage. Mm-hmm. And Josh, you mentioned the soundtrack even for that episode too. And I think shout out to like the soundtrack for every episode. The music is really good in every episode.
I cannot believe I've never really examined that. Is there like a regular crew or a regular composer?
Can't imagine. Like, we can look it up, but I have to imagine that was just kind of like Los Angeles Wrecking Crew studio musicians with
it had to be
cellos and just recording all the
singular one or two people. We would know that, I think.
Right.
But I'm definitely going to look into it after this, because it's just something that's never crossed my mind. Like, actually, if one person was primarily responsible for all that or something. But
yeah, it's effective though. I love The Grave.
I mean, The Grave, I want to ask you something about it, because I don't remember this exactly. So it opens with the guy is shot by the other guys.
Right.
And then the guy that shows up, so he was like hunting, he was tracking that dude.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then was he, what was he upset that he was killed?
To an extent, I think he's upset that he wasn't the one to, to get to do it.
But there's this sort of like underlying story going on that even though he was hunting the guy, he wasn't actually trying to catch him. That he might have been afraid of him.
That he's all talk.
Yeah.
Yes. He's all talk about it. Yeah.
Okay.
Because there's that whole exchange about like how the character supposedly waited for him to show up in Albuquerque so that they could have their showdown, and then he never shows up. And then he claims that he actually did go to Albuquerque and couldn't find the guy. And it's just like, who do you believe in that?
It's like, I really wanted to track this guy and kill him.
Yes.
Boy, howdy, am I going to do it one day? I'm a tough guy. I'm going to do it. Oh, he's dead. I'm going to show up to the bar and swagger in and talk tough now.
Exactly.
Even though I've been afraid of him the whole time.
Exactly. And honestly, I try.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great episode. So.
Oh, it's too bad he's dead. I would have done it. Uh-huh.
And
I just love that the fragile masculinity on display there. Like treating fragile masculinity in the early 60s.
Yeah.
Wow.
Actually a common theme too, now that I think about it.
I think it is too.
Slightly veering off, is there an episode that y'all return to a lot where you just have, I mean, there's a lot of episodes that I always have a lot of questions about, but I do know that there's like one in particular that I've watched more than others, and I don't feel like I'm any closer to understanding it.
Oh, really?
Which is, well, it's weird. It's a complicated episode historically anyway, but it's I Am the Night, Color Me Black. It's believed that Rod Serling wrote that episode in response to JFK's assassination.
Whoa.
But essentially what's happening in the episode, if you're not familiar with it, is that there's a man set to be hung in the morning. The reason why he's said to be hung is because he killed another man, but it turns out that he killed someone in defense of someone else. This guy was essentially a supremacist who was terrorizing, you know, people of color in the city. And this guy finally stands up to him, and it ends in death. And the reason why the episode is called I Am the Night, Color Me Black is because the day never dawns on the day of his execution. It actually stays dark the entire time.
Wow.
And there's this great shot. You should watch the episode of the man. I believe his name is Jaeger. I might be wrong, but there's this fantastic shot of, like, you see the noose and then you see his terrified face, like, perfectly framed in it. And the execution does go through, but the sun never rises. And there's, like, this, you hear at the very end, this sort of radio announcer saying, like, oh, all of these places around the world, which at the time were experiencing conflict, are also now shrouded permanently in darkness. And there's this excellent, like, exit narration. And it's a fantastic episode, but it's also a very complicated episode. And I have seen it more than any other episode because I was like, oh, I really want to, like, watch this and write about it and explore it. And I still have not gotten any closer to figuring out where I would even go with that. And is there an episode like that for y'all? Or am I just...
One that baffles us? Wow.
Like, just completely for years has baffled me.
No, but
I'm
like...
writing that one down. I need to watch that one. Like, yeah, ASAP. It is, that sounds incredible.
I Am the Night, Color Me Black. It's season 5. I don't remember which episode.
The one I always return to is kind of silly because it's... I believe it's the only one that was already pre-made and they just aired it, mm-hmm. that occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's the only one that they picked up. Like, someone else made it as a short film or whatever, mm-hmm. and Rod Serling was like, I'm airing this as an episode. And that the reason I return to that one is because, first of all, it's Ambrose Bierce, who's like an awesome horror author, wrote it. Mm-hmm. But also, second of all, it's the first one I saw. It was in school... you know, to see this black and white 23-minute movie that told an entire story in, like, middle school or whatever it was, like, blew our lids, you know? Because, like, every black and white movie we had seen up to that point was kind of like some long-winded, dialogue-driven, you know, thing that mom or dad were watching, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. Am I right, you two, that's the only one? I think it's the only one that they did not, like make themselves.
Possibly, we'd have to look into that.
Okay, we'll look into it. But it's the fifth season.
It's late in the run. It's very late.
You know what? Maybe they were kind of like, we're short an episode. What do we got out there?
Right.
Do you know the premise of that one?
Could you remind me?
Where the dude is set to be hung off a bridge, and then they, you know, they shove him off the bridge, whatever, and then the rope breaks. He falls into the water. Everyone's shooting at him. He, like, you know, swims across the river. He gets through the woods. They're all, like, following him, blah, blah, blah. It's this unbelievable, like, 20-minute, like, adventure chase. And at the very, very end of it, the rope just around his neck. And you realize the whole thing was a fantasy on the way down.
Oh, my goodness.
And you're like,
now I have to go watch that episode when I get home.
Yeah.
I love it. Oh, that's like your favorite, or the episode you've been talking about.
Which one? I talked about a few.
Perchance to Dream.
Oh, Perchance to Dream. Oh, man.
That sort of like twist at the very end.
Perchance to Dream, what's going on there is something I always respond to, though, in Twilight Zone episodes. And this isn't plot, or I'm going to be more the technical guy, the guy who says, isn't the soundtrack great? Isn't the sound design great? Isn't, like, the simple setups and the atmospheric quality of everything so great? But yeah, I just love, like, when you think of filmmakers later who tried to capture dreamlike imagery, like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, this is the early 60s and it has that trippy quality to it. And you can just see that they're working with so little, but using it so strategically.
Oh, I'm so glad you just said that. Keep going.
Well, yeah. And then again, the twist ending, which was, we have to also remark upon, something that 1961 audiences were completely not used to. They were used to mostly contained stories with wrapped up endings at the end. The whole M. Night Shyamalan phenomenon was just completely something no one encountered back then.
Right. And I made sure that I watched that episode yesterday. And I was like, oh, yeah, I remember this one.
Right.
It's real weird and trippy. And then, you know, the end of him dreaming, which you find out at the very end that he's actually been dreaming this entire time, even though he's afraid to sleep. that he jumps out the window and it turns out that he actually just died in his sleep, which was his fear all along. And I was just like, well, that's that. There's the end of the episode.
That is heavy.
That was like, oh, well.
That is heavy. This character that you've spent 28 minutes getting somewhat emotionally attached to is now dead. And I think random.
You know, that's Beaumont as well. Yeah. That's Howling Man. Yeah. That's, I think he had an entire collection called Perchance to Dream.
Nice.
Back in the day.
A lot of people talk about how Twilight Zone is capturing the human condition often. Mm-hmm. There are other episodes that are, for me, just all about panic and a sense of detachment from reality. And that's where Mirror Image comes in for me, which I really love, which was really interesting to rewatch. Mm-hmm. Because for the first 15 minutes, I don't know if this is a reach, but I almost wondered if it was getting into territories of a commentary on gaslighting, the supposed neurotic woman.
Right.
And I don't know if it follows through really on that. I think it just gets into straight up, there are creepy people who are coming out of the mirror to replace you.
Right.
Which is a lark in and of itself in terms of a horror genre. But again, I'd still admire how they technically pulled it off.
Yeah, and there's always that kind of like horror tie to, I don't know, passageways, like train stations in my limited knowledge of horror outside of the Twilight Zone are always kind of like a common, like, oh, there's something weird about this train station this bus stop. I don't know. I'm just making things up now, but
or a river, you know, or a river, Josh.
Liminal spaces. That's what you're describing, right? Like, you know, and that's what the Twilight Zone is—a liminal space, right? Like it's you're spot on.
Hell yeah!
And I love that you're bringing up the simple set design and the soundtrack and these things, because Allison, my fiance, and I went to a one act play recently, and it was, and you realize like all you need is like the chair and the counter, like, and the one painting on the wall, and I think that there's something a lot of the times in like modern like horror or sci-fi where there's this sense that they're trying too hard, or the effects weren't that great,
right,
or this or that. In the Twilight Zone, you never have to worry about those things, because it's presented in this almost do-it-yourself, this simple economical one-act play vibe.
Absolutely. And that's what's about Perchance to Dream, is when he goes into the dream sequence where he's sort of in the carnival, it looks like I say this with love, like a cheap haunted house.
Oh yeah.
Of any tri-county fair. It just black curtains and stuff. And it works.
Yeah, it's actually so creepy.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is about like the shots, like the angles of the shots. If you look at it, it's kind of hazy. Everything is at an angle where it's sort of tilted downwards.
It's like that 1960s Batman style where everything was slanted.
Yes, it's like these things, which technically aren't that scary, but are peering at you the entire time, or at the character who you are in place of during those shots. It's very unsettling. And that's probably why I like that show so much, is because the kind of horror that I like is the unsettling kind of horror. I don't really like jump scares or gore necessarily. It's the I feel uncomfortable existing right now kind of horror.
Would you like to comment on that, Josh?
I could not be more with you than I am. I have a million books to recommend that fall into this. One is Pen Pal. I'll just throw it out there, where a group of kindergartners are assigned to, like, you make a little note and tie it to a balloon saying, like, will you be my friend? And you, like, the address of the school, and you send off the balloons, you know. And then one kid, you know, all the kids receive letters back, you know. But one kid's letter back's from, like, not a very good person. The wrong person got this balloon, you know.
Oh, no.
And that's that kind of just unsettling. The Twilight Zone is like exquisite at that. It's the best. I think I almost don't even want to bring it up because it's like the seminal like episode, but Eye of the Beholder.
Yes.
Is so genius. Mm-hmm. From set design to concept to twist to like iconic imagery, like their faces revealed at the end, to what it says about how what beauty is, to what it says about the things that we care about. I mean, it's absolutely a stunner, that one. And it's exactly what we're saying. It's interesting because we're saying we don't like jump scares, and Twilight Zone isn't that. But at the same time, most of them, or a lot of them, have that twist, which is it's not a jump scare, but it's like a gasp.
Exactly.
Right. It's like a gasp scare. Yeah.
Right, right. Because one of the scariest images from Mirror Image, which is an interesting, I guess this is an interesting scene, but it works for me. We were commenting on the trick effect of the mirror image of the man running mm-hmm. in front of the other man trying to catch up to him.
Yes.
And yeah, maybe you can see that this is a split screen situation and the check, but there's something eerie.
Yes.
About it. And it lasts for almost 60 seconds of screen time.
It's a full like.
And it's not a jump scare, but it is damn right scary. I wanted to talk about this is the context of the time in which this is happening. There's Cold War tension. So they do have episodes like Will the Real Martian Please Stand Up or The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street? Maybe some political commentary.
Actually, yeah, no, 100%. Because it's all about, you know, Red Scare, like accusing your neighbors, you know, reading a lot into. I just watched this episode last night because I knew Jeff wanted to talk
the monsters?
About it. Yeah, and I was just watching it and I was just like, yeah, pretty much the neighbors are just reading into every little thing. Like, oh, why does that guy like to go outside at night and look at the stars? And he's like, I'm an insomniac. That's normal. But in the context of what's happening, it's like, are you really an insomniac or is it secret? Why is this guy working on a ham radio in his basement? What's that about? And it's just, yeah, no, it was 100% just...
You know that- I feel like that's really equatable to like modern day, like social media and stuff, this sense of like not paranoia, but like the sense of like, what do they mean by that?
Yes.
Like, what does this person mean? Where are they coming from? Mm-hmm. Are they coming from, you know, a good place and are they not? And there's this heightened like sense of distrusting your neighbor on social media as well.
There's an association factor. It even gets down so granular as, why did you like that post?
Yes.
Oh, why did so-and-so even share that post? I don't know. Paranoia. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so that's a timeless episode in of itself. Like every time I watch The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, I'm like, oh, this feels really apt right now. Every single time that I watch it, it just never really goes away. And hopefully that won't always be the case. But
we talked about liminal spaces. There's something also about the contained space. And that's something that I also like about the production of Will the Real Martian Please Stand Up? It kind of zooms. It zooms in on the bar. You see what happens in the bar. Mm-hmm. And then it zooms out of the bar. Mm-hmm. And we're done. The rest of the world would not know or does not currently know what happened in that bar.
Dude, exactly. What a brilliant thing, because it's almost like saying like, we're high viewers. We have found a pocket of the world that nobody else knows. And we're going to zoom in on it.
Right.
And you're going to see what's going on in that little corner pocket of the world, this little fold in the universe. And we're going to show it to you. And then we're going to zoom back out and you're going to go on with your night. Mm-hmm. And you're right. It really is sort of like being let into that liminal space. I mean, even through the shots. Wow. Mm-hmm. I'm not only going to watch the ones we're talking about, but I think I'm going to go on a bender and watch every single one. Don't you think it's about time?
I think it is about time. I think it is about time.
You made sure that you've seen every single one.
I try to have a marathon like every year if I possibly can. But I do notice myself skipping around to some of my favorite episodes sometimes. Yeah. So I need to just like sit and just let it happen.
Yeah. One other shout out is the one I just watched recently called, and I don't know if it's really a great episode, but I kind of like it. It's called A Thing About Machines, and it's about a writer, Josh, who's afraid of all the machines in his house. It's another contained story. It just goes into his mansion, and I think it's really poignant because it is supposed to be sort of scary and eerie, but it's also about a lonely, cranky old man who's really afraid of being alone.
Does he have like a helper or a housekeeper or something?
He has an assistant who's helping him write.
Assistant.
Yep. A typist of sorts. And I don't know. There's a lot of vulnerability there.
So there's this thing that the Twilight Zone does that doesn't, slight departure, doesn't, in my opinion, get talked about enough. And that's just that it has some real emotionally hard-hitting episodes. There's a couple that I'm thinking about, but I'm just going to mention, when I say a couple, I mean like five, which is The Changing of the Guard. I don't know if you both are familiar with that episode, but there's this teacher who's been a teacher for over 50 years and he's being forced to retire. And teaching has been his entire life at this point, and he feels like he still feels like he hasn't done enough, that there's something incomplete about his life. So he is planning to then take his life, but he's called back to his classroom, and most of the action takes place in the classroom, where it's then full of former students of his who have passed for various reasons. Some are like war heroes. One was a doctor who was treating cancer patients and got radiation sickness. And it's one of the most beautiful episodes I've ever seen. It's so emotionally hard hitting the entire time. And then at the end of the episode, it ends very happily for the Twilight Zone, which is that he does decide to retire. And, you know, he goes home and a group of his current students are outside of his house, like caroling for him as a sort of like, just like, I don't know, a show of honor. I watched this episode before I watched Dead Poets Society, just veering off really quick. And I was like, is this the same? Because I watched it when I was a kid, and I was like, and then Dead Poets Society when I was in high school, and I was like, this feels vaguely familiar to me. But that's one episode that comes to mind. And then another, which does not end happily, which is called The Purple Testament. That's a season one episode where it's set during World War II. I believe the main character is in the South Pacific, and he can look into people's faces and they get this sort of glow, and he can see how or when or if they are going to die, essentially, in battle. And I don't know if you guys have seen these, so I like kind of want to tell you what happens, but I don't, because I'm like, it's been 60 years. Is it a spoiler?
I don't think it's a spoiler. Also,
like, the episode ends with him then seeing that glow in his own face, and he rides off knowing, like, he hops into the Jeep or whatever, knowing that, you know, he's not going to make it. And once again, emotionally hard-hitting episode. And it's just, the reason why I bring them up is because I love the paranormal. I love the creepy psychological thriller aspects of the Twilight Zone, but they also have these, like, there's also these extremely well-written, just emotional episodes too, that, you know, might borrow from some of the other themes, but kind of stand alone in their own right too. Yeah. So.
I don't know if there's ever been someone more aware of the fact that it's the body of work, it's the tapestry of the episodes rather than a singular episode than Rod Serling. Like, because he could do something like that, aware that there's already, or maybe the next week is a horror, or the week and the week before was something more, you know, sci-fi, something more maybe traditionally Twilight Zone. And so, and when you start to, and it's, he was doing it right from the start, that variety, and not afraid to quote unquote genre hop, and not afraid to get serious. Or as you said, even there was that kind of a happy ending for that one. Like, he can do anything. Again, this comes back to the Twilight Zone itself. He came up with a scenario in which he can do anything he wanted or felt compelled to do within the Twilight Zone, and it was permissible and worked.
Right.
Because it takes place in the Twilight Zone.
Right.
And so rather than trying to, and I think that maybe someone would make that mistake today, or a lot of us might, rather than, you know, oh, you know, my show is supposed to be scary, or my show is supposed to be, you know, hard hitting, or my show, no, it can be many things.
Right.
Like, I mean, listen to the variety of things that subjects and premises and tonalities that we're bringing up just in this short conversation. And, right. You know, we've only talked about like 6 or 7 or 8 episodes.
Right.
I mean, this is a tapestry. And I just believe that he was aware of that from the start.
This brings me back to something you and I have talked about in another interview, though, Josh, and you as a storyteller maybe can resonate with this. And we're kind of nearing that. This notion of, or maybe a self-imposed pressure of, I need to up the scares. I need to make this scare scarier than the previous scare, or this episode needs to be more intense than the previous episode. It all needs to keep getting bigger rather than have that variety of tones. And
yeah. Right. And the danger there is that you then at some point jump the shark, right? Because right. you've lost like the delicacy. You've lost like the, as you brought up before, like the unnerving, that sort of quiet, you know, quiet horror is almost like a misnomer because it implies that it's boring or slow. It doesn't have to be slow.
Right.
It's just not leaping out, you know, leaping at you like googly eyed, like Large Marge.
Right, exactly. But my, the first example I reach to, and I say this with love, but you know, if you look at the trailer maybe for Stranger Things season 4, it looks like a bonanza carnival action, noise, fireworks, everything, whereas season 1 was probably relatively quieter. And that is because they have had this pressure to just keep making it busier and busier. And so
you're writing into the thing where I'm like, I haven't watched that TV show.
That's okay. That's okay.
But I mean, just to take it down.
But you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, because that's a common theme, and I'm going to say it, anime, where you run into this problem where they're just like, oh, we have to keep raising the power skills to like keep them intrigued. Like this fight scene has to last for an entire season.
Because last season it had lasted for half a season.
Exactly. Now and it's just, you lose the story in that. I'm kind of a story first kind of person, which is why I like anthologies and short stories so much, because that the story is the reason being like.
Absolutely.
So. I agree. And then, what's it called? Oh, a great example of what you're talking about, Jeff, is Saw. Because everyone's like, oh, Saw is the goriest, craziest thing. If you go and watch the first one, which is the only one James Wan did, there's no blood in it.
No.
It's like, there's a moment where the guy puts the saw to his leg and then they just show him like, ah!
Right.
But you don't see it.
Right.
The franchise becomes the bloodiest, goriest, craziest thing ever.
Right.
And so there must have been this sense of now we got to ramp it up. I ran into this with Bird Box, where I'm not going to say who, but you know, as I'm working on Mallory, some people are suggesting like, you know, Mallory should now be like, you know, in charge, like a badass creature killer.
She should be like Sarah Connor.
Yes, no, that name came up, believe me. And I read Bird Box in preparation for Mallory with the, like intentionally looking for just the same rhythm. So I wanted Mallory to start on the same beat and also the same size of whatever we're talking about right now. Like Mallory didn't have to be any bigger than Bird Box. It didn't have to try to outdo it. And I almost like in a punkish way, almost wanted to make it a lot smaller, but I didn't. It ends up, it's about the same if you ask me. And very conscious of what you're talking about right now. And again, it seems like by virtue of the setup of the anthology and especially the Twilight Zone, Rod Serling never really had to worry about that because there's so much room for variety instead of a one note thing that you're trying to outdo each episode or each season.
Right. There's a fantastic episode for this too, which if I'm not, I haven't watched it recently, but I do vaguely remember it, which is called A Game of Pool.
Oh, love that one.
Where literally the entire episode takes place just around a pool table, just about. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's like some lead up. And then there is, of course, the twist at the end, which is an amazing twist, but that's what I like about it. The scale is so small and yet so much happens. And those are some of the, like, as I'm looking at the episodes on my list, there's a lot in which, you know, it's just a very small scale, takes place mostly in one room, and yet it does so much.
Right. And then my further comment on the variety, I'll just name two episodes and put them side by side, an apple and an orange. You could have The Obsolete Man, which we've talked about, the librarian, the dystopian, Orwellian, personal opinion, Academy Award quality storytelling with a twist that is dramatic and kind of grave. And then you could have To Serve Man, which has a campy looking alien and the twist is almost a joke. So it's all within the same banner.
So does that speak to Rod Serling being well-rounded, open-minded? Does it speak to like the network being open-minded? You know what I mean? I always wonder, not that it really matters because who cares who gets all the credit or not, but it's so genius, this show, and it's so brilliant that I can't help but when I think of Rod Serling, it's like, I'm just completely in awe of this, you know?
I mean, as far as I know, at the time, it wasn't generally believed that this kind of series would, you know, gain the traction that it did or be popular as it was, because they were just like, who wants to watch a sci-fi anthology series? And Rod Serling was like, I bet there's a lot of people who want to watch it.
Exactly.
And yeah.
Rod was really influenced by pulpy novels, but, and this is pulpy to an extent, mm-hmm. but he was also really influenced by a lot of like weird theater and weird radio programs. And
And he also was really critical of television as a medium at the time, because while we are talking about all of the sort of expansive things that he did with it, he was doing things that no one else was willing to do at the time, because he's just like, well, you all are telling the same stories. You're casting the same people. There's an episode also in season one, which features primarily a black cast, which was not common at the time. It's called Big Tall Wish. And it's about a boxer and a boy who wishes that he will win this big match. And it's a sad, it's a bittersweet kind of sad episode and things like that. But Rod Serling was one of the only people at the time who was willing to take a gamble on something like that, because he was just like, you all are not using this medium to its full potential. So definitely early on, a lot of that, insofar as your question, was, in my opinion, definitely Rod Serling just like pushing the envelope, just like, I'm going to take this opportunity to show what can be done.
Absolutely. We have to mention a very late season, season five or season four, we have an episode called The Encounter with George Takei. That's an episode that is almost entirely about casual racism, mm-hmm. Which was in the air. There was, you know, there was Guess Who's Coming to Get Dinner or The Defiant Ones. There was lots of stuff, but that was an episode that I read some trivia on that they weren't going to even allow me to be in syndication. Mm-hmm. It aired once and then it became a hard to find episode because of the social commentary involved with it. So interesting. I did it before we even wrap and before I let you go, I just wanted to pick your brain. Josh, you've had the opportunity now to write for episodic television. Can you just speak generally on how maybe your perspective on it has changed being on the other side of that?
Well, okay, so a short story of mine, The House of the Head, was made into a Creepshow episode. Well, two short stories, but that was the first one. And there was, in the same way with Bird Box, there was like a sense of like, oh, go make whatever you're going to make. And I'm so freaking happy. And there was some of that here too. But at the same time, because it was so small and manageable, we're talking like a 20-page script or something, and it was so manageable, I wrote the script for that, I felt a little bit more than normal, like, no, I'm going to weigh in on this one, you know? And I like met up with the director, and who is freaking amazing, John Harrison. He did the soundtrack for the original Creepshow movie. I mean,
wow.
Yeah. And I'm like talking to this guy about, it was just unbelievable. And he was asking me like, do you think that I should snake the camera through the dollhouse? I'm like, yes, you know, like losing my mind. They wanted to change the ending from the short story. I'll just tell you, the short story ends with her name's Elvie in the story and Evie in the show, I'm pretty sure, or vice versa. But the short story ends with she has like a necklace now of the dog, and its like belly is kind of big because it ate the house, the head in the house. So in the show, they wanted some, because like the idea was that it never breaks the plane of the house. Like she's in no danger. Her family's in no danger. The figurines are in danger. That's the whole premise here. And I think it's pretty obvious, you know, talking about characters, how many, four or five characters in search of an exit. And here I am, figurines in peril, right? I mean, and I'm a huge Twilight Zone fan. So there's a direct line for me to all of this. But when they wanted to change that ending to something bigger or whatever, I just kind of felt like to myself, like, it's TV. Okay, go ahead, mm-hmm. do it. Mm-hmm. And like, I didn't do it. They did it. And I was like, fine with it. And I watched it later and I'm like, yeah, am I a fan of the quieter thing? Yeah. So what that did for me though, is forever I've been a Matheson, Beaumont, Bradbury, all these, you know, a lot of the Twilight Zone group writers, like fan of theirs. That's like it's almost like for a guy like me, it's like the beatniks of horror, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And now I have to pause and be like, maybe Beaumont didn't want that ending. Maybe Matheson was unhappy with that ending, and like it's not on him if this or that happens, you know? But it's more important, and I think that they would agree, it's more important that like the story is made that it's, all right, it's close enough to what you were going for. It's not going to be perfect. Movie and TV is a collaborative process. You're not alone in your room. You know what I mean? Like, all right, fine, let's roll. Mm-hmm. And so there was a sense I ran into my first, like, we're going to change this on you. And I was happy to discover I was okay with it.
Yeah. And I think that we can maybe presume that Rod was also open to that collaborative process, having a lot of ideas in the room, potentially. He's front and center. He's in the suit. He's welcoming us every episode. But I'm sure there's a whole gang behind him week to week, and different people week to week. So yeah, that's great. Closing thoughts on the Twilight Zone, Roddy? We did an entire episode on the Twilight Zone. Wish fulfillment.
My closing thoughts, if I could real fast, my big tall wish is that we do this again. And what I want to do is I want to get a yellow pad and I want to go through, I'm going to watch the whole thing.
Okay.
And I'm going to make notes on each episode. Yeah. And I'm going to start to make a list, like the scariest ones, like mm-hmm. you guys were saying, and the most emotionally hard hitting. Cause like, it's just time. Like, you know, you watch, I'm like, how many have I seen? Like how many episodes are there?
I don't even know. There's not, well, let's see, five episodes and five seasons. And I think 30 episodes per season, roughly.
It's gotta be around
140.
But okay. Also season four were the hour long episodes. So that was a shorter season.
Right.
We didn't even talk about season four.
We can do it next time. You know what? This works out perfectly. It gives us something to do with our summer. Instead of going to the beach, we're going to sit inside with the lights off watching Twilight Zone. And we can reconvene maybe in time for October 2nd, which is the anniversary of its premiere in 1959. Whoa. I feel like
packed now. We have to do it.
I'm in. Great. Yes.
Which may or may not be officially Twilight Zone Day, so we'll just reconnect.
I mean, it is now for me.
Right.
Yeah, right. Starting right now, it is for me too. Yeah.
But I think, one last comment I'll say is that Roddy and I are both avid readers. Josh, you're a reader. You're a writer. I think that we can just all agree that this is a masterclass in short storytelling from simple, seemingly simple premises. Mm-hmm. It just makes me so almost envious sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
Look absolutely at what they thought of.
Yeah. No, it's probably one of my biggest
And again, and I've been saying this the whole time, but a crew and a leader in Rod Serling that were not afraid of variety.
No.
And that is the whole thing. That's the reason we're still talking now, is that this was not a one note.
No.
Never. This was a freaking chorus. And yeah. And so genius.
Yeah. Yeah. And you don't have Creepshow. Hell, you don't even have Goosebumps without the Twilight Zone.
Oh, absolutely not.
No. Nope.
Thank you, Rod Serling.
Josh, thanks for joining us on a podcast about the Twilight Zone, and thanks for all your insights. This is a blast.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was just, I could just listen to the two of you talk. Every time you guys started talking, I felt like I was like learning everything.
That's so
that was fun. Awesome. Thank you, too. Thank you.
And that was Roddy and I talking to Josh Malerman, three huge fans of The Twilight Zone, for no other reason other than we just love The Twilight Zone, but we also love storytelling. If you're in a library, it's full of books, it's full of stories. We have the entire five seasons on DVD. Check them out. Library plug. And we'll be back at the end of the summer. We'll connect with Josh again.
Yeah, we'll have a lot to talk about.
You have listened to another episode of the Ferndale Libraries podcast. It's called A Little Too Quiet, brought to you by the Friends of the Ferndale Library. The music you hear at the start and end of each episode is by local musician John Duffy. If you'd like to support this podcast, visit ferndalefriends.org or just rate, review, or follow us. Tell a friend about us. If you have friends who are fans of Twilight Zone, share this episode to social media. We'll be back next week with more. Thanks for listening.